As students head back to school this month, there's a ramped up effort here in Jacksonville to get them healthier and less overweight. We're talking about childhood obesity this morning and what to do about it. Good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Download our podcast on iTunes or NPR One app and watch the show, video on demand, with our partner, TVJax.com. Just ahead, we're going to tell you how kids and educators are fighting childhood obesity in this area. Get on the line now with your thoughts. Join the conversation at 549-2937. Then later, does diplomacy matter in today's troubled world? A talk with Ambassador James Jeffrey as he speaks in town. Plus, our book club today looks at diaries and journals and why they actually always fascinate the reader. We'll tell you about it, all of that ahead. But first this hour, it's a new way to fight a serious public health problem in this country and right here on the First Coast, childhood obesity. About 13 million kids and adults in this country are considered obese. Now, here in Florida, the numbers are a little better, and there has actually been a slight decrease in obesity among the state's preschoolers. But as kids prepare to head back to school this month, many of them are ironically overweight, but at the same time, food insecure. They're not getting access to enough healthy food every day, like fresh produce. Student leaders in Jacksonville's I'm a Star Foundation are resolute in their quest to eradicate childhood obesity in this city and make Jacksonville one of America's top 10 healthiest cities. And they're going about it in a smart way. We're going to share all the details as we welcome former Duval County School Board member and founder of the I'm a Star Foundation, Betty Burney. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa, and thank you for having me again.
Great to see you. Also with us, Alexandria Perry. She is a rising 12th grade student at First Coast High School. Good to see you.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. We have epidemic rates of childhood and adolescent obesity in this country. What are your thoughts about that, and what are your questions about how the I'm a Star Foundation is working to bring those numbers down here in Jacksonville? Get on the line now, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, weigh in on our Facebook page. So, Betty Burney, let's begin with you. You founded I'm a Star because, as a former member of the Duval County School Board, you know firsthand that this is a serious public health problem for our students.
It's absolutely critical because it's not just childhood obesity, it's the effects of childhood obesity that really is detrimental to young people. If they start off obese and they don't exercise, they don't eat, have the proper diet, then they grow into obese adults. But childhood obesity brings on things like diabetes, high blood pressure, hypertension, not to mention the things that can cause kids to be bullied.
Absolutely. There's a whole range of negative impacts. They can also be more susceptible to emotional problems.
Exactly.
Depression, anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, suicidal thoughts. It's serious.
It's very serious. And the fact that young people in the I'm a Star Foundation are trying to find ways to eradicate childhood obesity speaks volumes, because the children have to take ownership of something that is actually impacting them.
Now, Alexandria, you're a rising 12th grader at First Coast High School on the north side, and you are trying to be part of the solution along with some other students. What is going to be happening this fall that's going to take a whack at this here in Jacksonville?
Well, the JTA came to us with this project called the Rosa Produce Market, which we open on Fridays at 10 a.m. And basically, we go and we just sell fresh fruits and vegetables. Like, we sell the sweetest peaches, the yellowest bananas. We also sell vegetables like tomatoes and a bunch of other stuff, you know. So we just want people to come out and support us and buy some fruit so they can be healthy. And also, the I'm a Star kids, we buy fruit too there. So we're actually helping ourselves too. So we just thought, you know, that the JTA, we were happy when JTA came to us with this project, and we're just happy to be able to be a part of it, and we're just really happy.
It's 549-2937 to learn about the I'm a Star Foundation's new produce market in downtown Jacksonville and how they're working on the issue of childhood obesity. We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Now, Betty Burney, the kids are going to manage this along with JTA. a fresh produce market at the Rosa Parks Transit Station in downtown Jacksonville. How did this all come together?
Well, you know, the one thing that I'm really happy about is 2 years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, the students started with trying to create healthy corner stores. So they would go out to corner stores in the neighborhood that normally sells chips, sodas, those kinds of things, and ask them to do fresh markets. When JTA approached us, we found that it was just a good fit. But the one thing that is so wonderful is that the passengers are coming to us saying thank you, because they now have an opportunity to get not only fresh, but it's cheap. You know, economical.
Yeah, it's a little mini farmer's market that's convenient for people, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And kids 11 to 18 are working on this project.
Yes, ma'am.
Do they get to take Friday off from school, or how does that all go together?
Well, we've been working over the summer so far, and so we're going to have a meeting to talk about what we're going to do and how we're going to be able to sell fruits and vegetables over the school year.
Yeah, and Melissa, well, I'd like for Alexandra to tell the listeners that this is their business. They've actually taken this farmer's market and they've turned it into a business.
Really? So tell us about the profit and loss. You're keeping the books. Where and is the money going back into the foundation?
Well, yes. Like Ms. Brandy said, this is our business. So we're the managers, we're the CEOs, we do everything. And so the money that we raise goes to us. It helps us with our college funds and scholarships for us. And also it really helps us in a way, like, because it teaches us how to have a business and stuff. And for me, it helps me because I'm the produce manager. And so it helps me to be organized, help me to, like, understand the stocks and, like, how much stuff we go, how much fruits and vegetables go in and out. And it's really benefit to me because I maybe think about going into business one day, and this is really helpful, and I'm glad that I had this opportunity.
Sure. It's a great opportunity. And let me ask you, too, as we talk about the issue of food deserts in this city, there are big areas of town where kids and adults are miles from any decent grocery store. If they don't have reliable transportation, they have really no way to get access to healthy, unprocessed foods. As you learned about that issue, as a high school student, I mean, a lot of kids don't want to eat their vegetables. My kids don't, but a lot of kids don't have the choice whether or not to eat their vegetables because they just aren't getting them into their diet. How did you learn about that issue when you became part of this?
Well, we saw that there were food deserts around our own area where we are and in our community, and we thought we need to do something about it. And so we thought this would be just a really great idea to, like, bring the fruits and vegetables to our community and put it in the local convenience stores, because we know that people don't have, like, the money to go to, like, these stores that are really far, or don't have the time to walk to all these stores that are really far from their home. So we thought it would be best to bring the healthy fruits and vegetables to them, to their local corner stores.
Betty Burney, people have sometimes, oh, and by the way, listeners, we're having a little issue with our phone lines. We're going to try to reboot that system and take your calls in a little bit. Betty Burney, people sometimes, when we talk about this issue on the show, as we try to educate the public, they don't often make the connection that a kid can be overweight and also hungry at the same time.
Exactly, because some of the overweight has to do with the fact that the things that they're putting into their system, they're not getting the water, they're not getting the fruits and vegetables, and that creates an unhealthy balance in their system. But the other part of the kids being hungry is that the snack foods are just fillers. You know, the chips and the cookies and the sweets, they just fill them for a moment, but they don't sustain them.
It's 549-2937, and apparently our phone lines are now working. We will go to your calls in a moment as we discuss the I'm a Star Foundation's efforts to combat childhood obesity on the First Coast. When you founded I'm a Star, was this your thought? Oh, I'm just going to set up fresh produce markets around the city? There's more to it than that.
There's more to it than that. And that was probably not even a thought at all. One of the things that it was founded for was for the young people to come up with solutions to negative things that affect them and affect their generation. And one of the things that was most impactful for them is that someone from the health department came out and shared with them that they might be the generation that would not outlive their parents. Mm-hmm. Talk about putting a spark under them mm-hmm. to make them want to do some things. So they've taken this journey even to the point of going to Washington, D.C. to present information to the United States Surgeon General and to bring him here to Jacksonville.
That's right. We did see the Surgeon General come to town a few months ago. You went up to D.C., didn't you, to meet with him?
Yes, ma'am.
What was that like? Tell me about that.
That was a really nervous but an exciting experience.
Uh-huh.
It was really great to go to be able to go talk to him, actually meet the Surgeon General of the United States and talk to him about our plan, our strategic plan, and our call to action about what we want to do to eliminate childhood obesity in our United States. So I really was really happy but nervous at the same time. It was a really great experience, and I'm really glad that we went up to Washington. I'm also happy that we were able to bring him back down here in April. And I was really happy that he just spent the whole entire day with us. We had breakfast. We did our breakfast with champions. We did our town hall meeting with 1,000 kids. And we did our 10,000 steps walk with him. And that was great.
Mm-hmm. Very mm-hmm. cool. And if you're just tuning in, as kids head back to school this month, there's a new effort via Jacksonville's I'm a Star Foundation to combat epidemic rates of childhood and adolescent obesity in this country and in this city. What do you think is contributing to that? What are your thoughts and concerns about childhood obesity? It's 549-2937 to join us, or you can tweet the show as well. Let me ask you, at your school, First Coast High School, no different than most other large American high schools, when you walk through the halls and you look around at your peers, how many of them would you say are overweight?
Well,
is it a big problem?
I would say yes. Well, I would say they're more like unhealthy, yes, because like all we have there are like sodas and a lot of like junk food. Mm-hmm. And I see a lot of kids always have like, they always go to the vending machine to get sodas and junk food. So I would say quite a bit of them.
What do you think about the effort in some schools to not have soda machines? It's been controversial. People have complained about it. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's something that should be done?
Yes. I really believe they should like eliminate like soda machines and like get rid of like all the snacks they have in the lines. Because there are like a lot of other healthier options, and I just feel like the sodas are not really, really helpful to the kids because it really makes them like really energetic in class and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I really believe that we should like eliminate soda machines and like some of the candies and like snacks that they have in the lunch line.
Betty, Bernie, what about that? Other school districts have looked at that, but it, of course, everything is political.
Yes.
And I've observed over the years this movement to when it comes to getting rid of the foods that cause the problem, there's always a pushback. The mayor of former mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, faced enormous criticism when he wanted to levy a really heavy tax on sugary soda drinks.
Exactly. And as a former school board member, I understand how, you know, there can be pushback sometimes if the constituents do or do not want something. But when we think about the impact of obesity on young people, and I think if that's explained to our constituents, it would be far easier for them to say, you know what, maybe we do need to push back a little bit and teach kids to have options and to think about a balance, a healthy balance. But I agreed with Bloomberg when he said
you thought that was a good thing to do.
Yes.
But let's be honest. Kids are going to be kids. If mm-hmm. the soda's there, I call it pop, I'm from the Midwest.
Uh-huh.
If the pop is there, they're going to take it. Is the solution to just not have it, not give that option?
I think that is the solution is not to not give it, but I think that the solution is to show the balance so that where you have the pop, you have the water. And maybe if you push the water up a little bit in front of the pop, the kids might get it. Or if there's information, kids sometimes operate on a lack of information. So if we could inform the kids, I think then that we have half the battle won.
Do you talk about this with your friends at school?
Well, no, not really.
Not really. Mm-mm. How did you get involved?
With I'm a Star, a few years ago, like 2014, my pastor went to Miss Betty Bernie, and he asked if some of his church kids could join her organization, and she was more than happy to welcome us, and I've just been happy ever since.
How has it changed your life?
Well, Miss Betty Bernie has really taught me how to be a leader and really taught me how to step up to the plate when it's time, and I'm just it's a really great experience because I learn if I see a problem, I learn to find the best solution for it, mm-hmm. and I go to her, ask her, I tell her about it, and we find a way to eliminate the problem that we see.
So on the surface, Betty, you're fighting childhood obesity, but it sounds like what you're also doing with I'm a Star Foundation is building kids' confidence and self-esteem.
Their confidence, their self-esteem, and then also the most important piece for me, Melissa, is to help them to learn to become servant leaders, because the greatest leaders are those who serve mankind. And I am just pleased when I see them getting out in the community and doing whatever it takes in order to serve.
And let's go to your calls right now. I'm a Star Foundation is working on the epidemic of childhood obesity in this city, setting up fresh produce stands at public transit stations and a whole lot more. We have a lot of work to do because kids are heavier than they have ever been, ever, with skyrocketing diabetes problems, other health issues, emotional problems related to this. What are your thoughts? What are your concerns? What are your questions? 549-2937 to join us. Tina is in Jacksonville. Hi, Tina. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Good morning, Betty. I just want to applaud Betty for her efforts and champion the work that she and her group are doing with I'm a Star. And
thank you.
I was fortunate enough to attend the ceremony with the Surgeon General here in Jacksonville, and it was a wonderful presentation put on by I'm a Star. So, just huge accolade to the group. One of the things I just wanted to mention, and I'll take your answer off the air, how much is, childhood obesity and food selection a part of sort of the choice and behaviors, when we're kind of pushing our carts through the grocery store? Mm-hmm. And also, how involved are the parents in this process of trying to make better choices, food choices for their families? Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you, Tina.
Thank you.
Yeah. What about those questions?
I think those are excellent questions. And all of it has to do, again, with education. The students in I'm a Star are partnering with the YMCA on a wonderful project. The kids are learning how to do aeroponic gardening, where they are growing fresh vegetables and fresh fruits. And then we're going to take all of the produce that we receive, take it out to places like Cleveland Arms or near any YMCAs, teach parents, teach senior citizens, and teach children how to eat healthy and how to make healthy choices.
That's such a big part of it. And
exactly.
There are a number of community gardens in the city now, especially in areas that are classified as food deserts. Do you think that's starting to make a difference?
I know that it's starting to make a difference. I have actually been proud to see so many young people, so many gardens that's springing up, and see to find people are saying, I would rather have a salad than to have X, and that makes mm-hmm. a big difference.
549-2937, as we talk about childhood obesity on the show this morning. Tracy in Mandarin. Hi, Tracy. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I am a physician myself. I tell you, I'm very strict about obesity in the last 40 years. This turned out to be number one disease, inviting diabetes, heart problem, high blood pressure. So I become very strict that you need to monitor diet and need to exercise and guide your children at this age. And I tell you, I'm strict about if you smoke, I will not see you. So patient listen to you. And I think this must be brought under control. Parents need to participate. Teachers need to participate. And students will listen to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think that the caller made a very good point. There's a domino effect, because even when you get the diabetes, if you have diabetes, then there's the things that happen with that. You know, you could have problems with blindness and all kinds of things. So there's a huge impact of childhood obesity.
Absolutely. And when you read the statistics from the Centers for Disease Control, kids are so overweight today that they are expected to have a shorter life expectancy than their parents. That is unprecedented in the history of the world.
It is.
That is horrifying.
It is. And that was the spark. Those words were what sparked our students to get so heavily invested and involved in this.
Yeah. Because you want to live to see old age, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And let's go now to, as we get her in the queue, Rebecca in Ponte Vedra. Rebecca, how are you?
Good morning.
What an excellent program. It just sounds
Thank
wonderful.
You.
And I want to congratulate the young student you have there. What an accomplished, well-spoken person, and what a bright future she has. And I also wanted to ask a question. Back to the issue of the unhealthy vending machines and soda pop in the school system. You had mentioned as a former school board member was an issue of politics. But I'm wondering, is this also an issue of what many things are, money? Are the schools given money by these food vendors in order to put these unhealthy products in the schools?
Sure, great
and
question.
If parents were made aware of that, it would be easier to get them out of the schools. And additionally, this wonderful farmer's market that you have going, I really hope that it does continue throughout the school year. And is there a possibility of doing a farmer's market at the school so that the students would have better, more interesting choices?
Thank you for that question. Sure. Thanks, Rebecca.
Thank you so much. One of the things that I will say is that, for instance, Chartwell, which is the food service agent vendor for the school system, is really working to bring healthy choices into Duval County Public Schools with the fruits, and they are going out and getting the oranges and those kinds of things. Having the farmers market at the school is a wonderful idea that I think we would love to explore. And the kids actually came up with their own strategic plan and call to action, and they have four steps that we want to spread to all of the schools to let the schools know what those four action plans are.
What are the four steps, Alexandria?
So our four steps are to be empowered, be active, stress less, and choose foods wisely.
What's a typical week for you in terms of your diet and exercise?
Well, normally I would have a salad at least maybe like once or twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I would put like some fun stuff in, like chicken, or maybe I'll have my salad with some chicken. But mostly I eat salad because I really like salad. And I try my best to have my dad go buy a lot of fruits and vegetables because I love cucumbers and I really, really love grapes and stuff. So I eat a lot of fruit and vegetables throughout the week.
Do you work out or do you have gym at school?
Yes, I'm in ROTC, and so okay. we have our workout, where we kind of work out like once or twice a week, and so that's really helpful for us.
And here, by the way, ABC News reported the other day that new USDA rules will require America's public schools to get rid of unhealthy snacks and eliminate students' exposure to junk food. The biggest change this year is that if a snack, food item, or beverage isn't considered healthy enough for a school to sell or serve, it won't be advertised anymore. No more advertisements, pictures of soda on vending machines. This coming from USDA because a study finds that 70% of elementary and middle school students see ads for junk food at school, and if they see the ad, they're more likely to buy the product.
They're more likely to buy it, and it also goes back to one of the callers that talked about when you're in the grocery stores. When you see the ads on television for cereal that contains a lot of sugar, they have the coolest ads, and you just really want to go out and buy those things. And so we need to really talk to individuals who are in the media to talk mm-hmm. to them about their advertising and what takes place.
But as the school year begins, actually, is the farmer's market already up and running on Friday?
Yes, the farmer's market has been open since July 15th.
Excellent. And now every Friday, the kids with I'm a Star Foundation will be set up at the Rosa Parks Transit Station, the JTA station in downtown Jacksonville. This is the busiest bus station in town. Every Friday, there will be a fresh produce market there. It will be part of the effort of I'm a Star to reduce childhood and adult obesity on the First Coast. So look for the kids there. They are running this in conjunction with JTA. Follow I'm a Star Foundation on Twitter for more information. And I hope you have a wonderful school year. Have you thought any more about what you're going to do after high school?
Yes, I want to go to college, and I'm thinking about going to FAMU because it's a family school. So I want to go to FAMU, and I'm thinking about either doing nursing or crime investigation.
Oh, wow. Two very different things. Well, I'm sure you'll be successful at whatever you choose, and I thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Melissa, for having us here today.
Betty Burney, former Duval County School Board member and founder of the I'm a Star Foundation, and we also spoke with Alexandria Perry, a rising 12th grader at First Coast High. And much more still ahead later. Our book club is cracking open the pages of your diary. Yes, diaries as a literary genre. But up next, from the Turkey coup to ISIS, diplomat James Jeffrey breaks down the troubles in hot spots across the world. He shares his insights right after this.
One of three Baton Rouge police officers ambushed and killed Sunday, Matthew Gerald, will be buried today.
He had a lot of pride in himself and his job, but he didn't want to boast about it. And when people thanked him, he said, hey, you know, I'm just doing my job.
The funeral of Matthew Gerald later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First are proud to present the 4th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire teachers. Saturday, October 8th at the Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Tickets are only $30. Spend the day sharing ideas with colleagues, learning new ways to engage students, and empowering yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, after a rocky few weeks for his campaign, Donald Trump releases his new economic plan. Analysis of his proposals on taxes, trade, and financial regulation, and how he's distinguishing himself from Hillary Clinton. At 10 o'clock on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, on Monday, Jacksonville's World Affairs Council hosted Ambassador James Jeffrey for a special sold-out gathering on diplomacy. One of the nation's most senior diplomats, Jeffrey has held a series of highly sensitive posts in Washington, D.C. and abroad, including stints in Turkey and Baghdad, Iraq. He also served as assistant to the president and deputy national security advisor in the George W. Bush administration, with a special focus on Iran. I spoke with Jeffrey in a wide-ranging discussion about hotspots around the globe and the vital role our nation's diplomats play. Let's listen. Ambassador, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
And
down here in Jacksonville.
Yes, and a sold-out talk for your appearance with the World Affairs Council of Jacksonville. And certainly your expertise is in great demand right now after the attempted coup in Turkey and other hotspots around the globe. The title of this talk, Does Diplomacy Matter, is intriguing. And of course, I would assume your response to that question would be yes. It's simplistic to ask about all the reasons why. Your insights are so important when it comes to these sensitive conflicts and these complex geopolitical relationships. But let me begin by asking you your thoughts about Turkey. There's a fairly significant Turkish population here in Jacksonville, and so people are following events there closely. As you watch that attempted coup take place, what are your thoughts about the way forward for the U.S. response to whatever unfolds in that country?
Well, the first thing to focus on is the fact that we are all very fortunate, beginning with the Turks, that this coup did not succeed. Unlike other military coups that have occurred in Turkey that were carried out by the military as a whole and resulted in a return to democracy quickly, this was done by a small cabal inside the military. We're still trying to look at who is behind it, but it was very violent, unlike all of the other coups, and it clearly was attempting to overthrow the democratic order. The Turks believe that an Islamic organization led by a man who is in exile, essentially, in America, Fethullah Gulen, was behind this. There's considerable evidence that that is so, but we're still waiting here in America to see the actual specifics of that. Nonetheless, it's a good thing that this thing was stopped in its tracks, because it would have plunged the country into civil war.
You have spoken out in favor of expediting the extradition request for Fethullah Gulen. He is linked to a number of charter schools in this country, including a few here in Jacksonville. What are your thoughts about that kind of odd element to that whole story?
Well, the Gulen organization has done a great deal of good around the world in charitable activities, in education, and frankly, in bringing together people of different religions and ethnic groups. I don't think there's any doubt about that. The question is its impact in Turkey. And I followed them closely during my tours in Turkey, and there's no doubt to me that the Gulenists have attempted to infiltrate government institutions, particularly the judiciary and the police, but we now apparently see in the military as well, in order to control decisions of the government to certainly fend off any action against them and possibly to seize control. It's just not very clear.
You're also an expert on Iran. You served the George W. Bush administration as a foreign policy expert there. You served as ambassador in Baghdad at a crucial time. When we look at the proliferation of ISIS in the region, how did we get from the situation 10 years ago to where we are today? And what is the way forward for whomever the next administration is in this country?
Now, that's a big chunk to bite off, but I'll try to do it at a general level. To start off with, the Middle East is vital to the United States. When we're doing this pitch tonight on does diplomacy matter, the answer is diplomacy as a skill set, tradecraft matters, but more importantly, foreign policy matters to the American people, whether it's fighting terrorism or dealing with the risk of a nuclear weapon to keeping a halfway stable world, to ensuring that oil continues to flow around the world from the Middle East. The Middle East is extremely important to the world as we know it today. It's long been a very turbulent region, but we've been able to basically deal with it. Beginning about the time of the 9/11 attack on the United States, the region began disintegrating into ever more instability, chaos, dysfunctionality, and we've had a hard time dealing with it since then. One aspect of that is the march of Iran throughout the region, taking advantage of the weaknesses of other countries. Another has been the rise of Sunni Arab Muslim extremist movements, first al-Qaeda and now ISIS. So in a way, it's not simply one problem. It's a whole series of problems that arise from the unique nature of this region compared to, say, South America, just to the south of here, or East Asia. And that's what we're having a hard time coping with.
Mm. Now, speaking of Iran, is it serious, the speculation that has been reported in recent months, that Iran might possibly consider with the U.S. in combating the Islamic State?
Iran is not part of the solution of anything. It's part of the problem. It's a opponent of the United States. It doesn't trust us. We shouldn't trust Iran. We just stopped yesterday another shipment of weapons that is a violation of UN resolutions to the Houthi rebels in Yemen. And this is the problem across the board. Does Iran see ISIS as its enemy? Yes, also al-Qaeda. Nonetheless, we know that there are al-Qaeda representatives who are still in Iran. In fact, U.S. Treasury just sanctioned three of them recently, just like Iran supposedly fights the Taliban, the Afghan group, yet an American strike took out a Taliban leader just as he was leaving Iran a month ago. So this is a kind of problem we have with Iran. Iran is not a potential ally here any more than Russia is.
As you look ahead to the presidential election, how do you see, what do you think is the correct strategy that is being put forth by the two candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump? How, in your view, will the next 4 years play out when it comes to the way American power would be applied in this region?
Well, first of all, I've worked for Secretary Clinton. She's a known force in terms of her foreign policy. She's been on the Senate Armed Services Committee. She was a very close advisor to her husband. As I said, she was Secretary of State for 4 years. Donald Trump is an unknown quantity, and there's good reason to not take too seriously any of his policy prescriptions up till now. So I have to leave him out of this, and this is the first time I would have done something like this in 50 years because we just don't know. With her, you will get a return not to the Obama administration, not to the Bush administration, but rather to the administration of her husband, Bill Clinton, and of George Bush Sr. And all in all, that will be a cautious engagement around the world. She will avoid large ground commitments of forces, but she'll be more willing to use military force if we're challenged in a limited way than President Obama has been. So it will be somewhere to the, if you will, right of President Obama and somewhat to the left, more cautious of President Bush.
And from the application of military force to exerting more soft power around the world, you're going to be speaking about how diplomacy impacts world events. Can you share with us a little bit more of what you'll be discussing in that vein? Because the title of the talk is Does Diplomacy Matter, of course.
Certainly. It will be a little bit of tradecraft. What do we mean by diplomacy? But sooner or later, you get from diplomacy as a skill set, negotiation, maintaining relations, knowing which fork to use, to diplomacy as a way of coordinating America's interests, its strengths, and its needs internationally with foreign actors to advance the interests of the American people. That's ultimately what diplomacy is all about. It's coordinating foreign policy in a structured and organized way. And this is needed because no matter how strong a country is militarily in terms of its trade, in terms of its energy and other resources, this country or any country has to deal with the rest of the world, whether it's negotiating a nuclear deal with Iran or whether it's in 1999, deciding under the Clinton administration that we had to use military force to stop what looked like genocide and the mass expulsion of a population in Kosovo. We act internationally. That action can be military, it can be economic, it can be political, but it all has to be coordinated, it all has to be explained, it all has to be exploited diplomatically to ensure that our goals are achieved. And that's what diplomats do.
Out of all your time in the trenches, do you have any stories from being a diplomat that would surprise people, that might go against the grain of the stereotypes or the biases they have about the countries where you were stationed?
Well, certainly one of my favorites was I was with George Bush at the Olympics. We have Olympics right now. This was 8 years ago at the Olympics in Beijing, when out of the blue, war broke out between Russia and Georgia. And I had to alert President Bush and the Great Hall of the People in Beijing to this fact and watch him and help him as he responded to it. The first thing he did was to literally run off and collar Putin at the time, the prime minister. And I watched how we used American power, but very, very carefully. Our assessment was that Russia's interests were greater than ours in Georgia, and that Russia had more of a preponderance of military force, and thus our options were limited. Nonetheless, we used them effectively. We used them through the French. We took some military measures, but we were very cautious, and we made it clear that things would be okay if Russia simply withdrew back to the starting position of its forces, and by and large, Russia did that. But it was very, very delicate because it was an issue of war and peace, the first with Russia since the 1970s and 60s.
Hmm. Well, it's fascinating to speak with you, and we thank you so much for giving us a few minutes of your time, Ambassador. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling.
And that was Ambassador James Jeffrey. He spoke last night in town, courtesy of the World Affairs Council. Well, if you're trying to stay cool out there this week, we want you to show us on Instagram. It's our I Love WJCT contest. Every week, we publish our favorite Insta snap of the week in our First Read newsletter. Now, this week's theme is Beat the Heat. If you're on Instagram, we want you to post a photo showing how you're staying cool out there this summer and supporting public radio all at the same time. Make sure to use the hashtag ILoveWJCT. When you post your photo, we will pick our favorite one of the week and send it out to all our subscribers this Friday in our First Read newsletter. Subscribe to that daily news e-blast at WJCTnews.org. And finally, this hour, if you've ever written the words Dear Diary, you know how powerful they can be. Diaries and journals can be fascinating, whether they're written by a famous person or not. And this morning, our own Stacey Goldring is encouraging all of us to read this genre. It's today's First Coast Connect Book Club, Dear Diary. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I am good. When I was in eighth grade, I had one that had a little lock and key.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if kids still do that today.
They're still out there, diaries and journals. And what I'd like to do is define diary versus journal, because I did not know that a diary is more of a daily report, like these are the C's today, this is what I did today, I planted this, that, and the other thing. The journal is the more personal one. I didn't realize that. But
okay.
If you go back to the French, you know, diary, diurnal, daily, or jour, which is day, which is French for journal, French. So the word journal is more French.
I want to make that connection.
Yeah.
Jour, meaning
day.
Today.
Yeah.
Journal.
Right, of today.
I never even made
that
connection.
Me neither. Who knew?
Okay.
So that's from the 14th century. And then if you go back to the Latin in the 1580s, that's where we get dies, day, diary, diurnal. But you hear the je, the your in
yeah.
journal also, in diurnal. So it all kind of, you know, meshes together.
Can I just tell a little story?
Please.
After my grandparents died, my mother was going through my grandma's diary, and my grandmother on my mom's side, and for 50 years, she wrote in her diary every single day.
Do you realize how important that is?
And I know. And my mom told me this story once that she just thought it was just horrifying and funny all at the same time. My grandparents, who were very conservative, and
is
very,
this in Dayton?
No, they were farmers in downstate Illinois.
Oh, okay.
They went to see, in 1967, they went to see the movie Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Oh my gosh, fabulous flick.
And when my grandmother got back, she wrote an entry about it in her diary.
And
she said, I fear for the future of this country. Pa and I, that's what she called my grandfather. Dad and I were horrified.
Oh,
and
my goodness gracious.
So my mom was showing me this and just like shaking her head and just, it was one of those things.
But that's the beauty of a diary. Yeah. See, it captured a time, it captured a place,
exactly.
It captured the culture, it's contextual realism. So we doth not judge your grandma.
That's right. They were creatures of their time.
That's right.
But that's why they're fascinating to look at, because they capture someone's life in real time.
Exactly. And I recently read a very interesting diary that I want to share with you. It's rather obscure, and it's a diary from Dixie, and it is about Mary Chestnut. And the reason why I picked up this fabulous book is I'm a big fan of Civil War history. I know that sounds kind of weird, but I can't seem to get my head around the whole slavery thing in America. Like, it just, I don't get it. But so what I have to do is take in all the knowledge that I possibly can to try to rationalize it, and I know you cannot. But anyway, that led me to Mary, right?
Okay
so I'm reading this book, and I'm finding it absolutely fascinating because she is taking in the war in real time. So as Fort Sumter happens, she's witnessing it on the top of an inn in Charleston. You know, as McClellan can't make up his mind, she's complaining about it. When Beauregard goes here, when her son gets hurt here. And so you're catching this all in real time, and you're also watching the complete collapse of the Southern culture.
Right.
So people are dying on the battlefield in Gettysburg, and she's having oysters for dinner.
Huh.
And wearing dresses made of French silk that cost $600, $700 for a dress and this for the bow and that. I mean, it was so interesting because it was a female perspective of the Civil War, which you don't have much of. Some nurses wrote, et cetera. But it really captured, I was just riveted. And I had a lot of biblionexu with this book, which happens with us well-read folks.
What does that mean?
Meaning that you're reading the book and then something happens in real life that complements what's happening in the book.
Oh, that's giving me chills.
Yeah, so I'll tell you more about that later in the segment, but I ended up being at a plantation in Charleston where she had been at the same time, which freaked me out. And then I had a cousin who was reading, we were at dinner, and he was reading a poem to me by Oliver Wendell Holmes about the one Hoss Shay. And I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but it's this amazing poem, and it's about technology today, which means everything, it's working, and then it breaks, and it's ruined, and you got to buy the new iPhone, or you have to buy the new whatever gadget, the new Keurig, or whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
But this poem refers to that type of technology, and she refers to one of her dresses as a one harsh shay, like all of a sudden it fell apart. What's going on here? But anyway, this is the beauty of diaries, is that you go there. You go there with that person or the journal, whatever it is. And I had to balance this journal or diary because it's obviously told from an extremely exclusive point of view. We could consider her a racist. She was a slave owner.
Uh-huh.
She was well-bred. She was a South Carolinian. She was a great dresser. She's a conversationalist. She knew how to entertain, blah, blah, blah. But then I wanted another perspective. So I am now halfway through this amazing book called Bullwhip Days, The Slaves Remember. And this is by James Mellon. All this is on the blog post, so people can check it out at the library. And these are not written diaries. These are oral compilations from over 2,000 interviews done by the WPA's Federal Writers Project during the 30s. These are 29 interviews of the other end of the spectrum.
There's so many to choose from in this genre.
Oh, fabulous.
And if you're just now tuning in, it's our book club right now with our own book club leader, Stacey Goldring. This month, we're focusing on diaries and journals. And if you have feedback for us, just email the book club, be part of the book club by emailing bookclub@wjct.org. The Jacksonville Public Library is our partner, and you can go to the downtown library for Stacy's picks. Look for them on the shelves. And you have a bunch of emails, I know, that you've gotten in the last few weeks.
Well, we've had a lot of response from the Perkins when we talked about Maxwell Perkins. A lot of people had tried to read a Thomas Wolfe, and they just couldn't get through it. But they have agreed. One email was from Deborah, who has agreed to give it another shot. And Rod is keeping me honest because I spelled Marjorie Keenan Rawlings' name wrong in my post. And I appreciate him calling me out on that because, you know, you need to be well edited.
That's
and so
true.
He was playing the part of my Maxwell Perkins.
That's true.
Nora also was very fascinated with the interview, and she would like to join the book club. So we'll have to see if we can't somehow put that together for her because, you know, the audience wants more. And we also had JN9289, who truly enjoyed the topic, rather obscure, but did enjoy it. So we're so grateful when people—
You got a lot of fans out
yeah,
there.
Yeah, and I have a little special. You were talking about your diary.
Uh-huh.
I have brought in my diary.
Oh, no.
I have my diary.
I wish we had this kind of music to play.
This is my diary from—
Oh, get out of here.
The third grade.
Look at that.
Can you believe it? See, the lock is gone, but that was the lock.
Oh, you can't lock it anymore?
No, but this was 1973, Stacey B.
Aww.
And
can
you know,
read one little entry at random?
I can't do that. I cannot reveal the deep, dark. I can tell you it was 1973.
You're not going to let me hear about, you know,
oh,
the boys
goodness.
Who had crushes on
you know,
and stuff
if,
like that?
If I know me and I know me very well, I probably erased everything once I saw someone try to tamper into
Aww.
It because I'm very paranoid. But it does talk about going to camp for the first time. And
uh-huh.
it's really quite precious. But diaries are a great gift for anyone, especially if you want someone to learn how to write, because it's therapeutic. Journaling is therapeutic. It's healthy for you, and it's a way to It's a way to get down on paper things that are crazy in your head, and you never, ever, ever have to read it again.
Now, but it's fun, as I was saying, it can be really fun to go back and read about your life years later or your family's.
Well, frankly, yeah. Evidently at one point I really liked Johnny McCormick, and then I didn't because it got... So there's that. Our library has some wonderful titles that I wanted to share with you that are in diary format. But a word to the wise, you have to make sure your diary that you're reading is either fiction or nonfiction, because I don't want my leg pulled. I want to know out of the box what I'm reading. So I'm recommending the following books. The Diary of a Provincial Lady, and that's a series, and it's fabulous. It's rather obscure, but fabulous. And I don't know, do you remember Go Ask Alice?
Yeah, sure.
It scared me to death!
Yeah.
Now, was it real?
Oh, I don't know.
According to Snopes, not so much.
Okay.
Evidently, there was a whole movement in the early 70s to write books for little kids like us at that time, so we would be fearful of drugs and broken homes.
So, oh, okay.
So there were a lot of books.
The diary version of Scared Straight.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So that's I hate to blow everyone's, burst everyone's bubble that, you know, remembers the Bugaloos and, you know, all that stuff back then. But Go Ask Alice, that didn't really happen. Diary of a Wimpy Kid.
And oh, yeah, my kids love those.
Flowers for Algernon, sure. Otello, et cetera. But let me just wrap up by saying, if you want to learn more about Mary Chestnut, who will show you the Civil War like no eyes, I suggest visiting or exploring Eliza Leach's house at Middleton Place in Charleston, or you can go on the website and read about it. The Magnolia Plantation also offers a tour about the slave quarters, which are very interesting, and they've
Heard
had to evolve over time because of what's happened in Charleston. It's so heartbreaking.
It's supposedly quite haunted there too, isn't it?
It's amazing. And of course, the old Slave Mart Museum in downtown Charleston, if you're going to go, that's the first place you have to visit. Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you. And email Stacy with your book club questions. Be part of the club just by emailing bookclub@wjct.org. Well, that's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Sean Birch. Michelle Corum is running the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Shevchik. We have a daily podcast on iTunes, or download the show at the NPR One app. Next on Diane Rehm, after a rocky few weeks for his campaign, Donald Trump has released his new economic plan. I'll look at that coming up. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.